Every who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot. But the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. He hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be, perhaps, that his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be that his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all was that his heart was two sizes too small. Whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, the Grinch stood there on Christmas Eve hating the Whos. I could go on, actually. I know most of this story. I grew up hearing this story read to me pretty much every day in December, so I've got most of it memorized. And this, to me, is the story of Advent, how the Grinch stole Christmas. If you're not familiar with it, it's a great Dr. Seuss story about a little strange green guy who tries to steal Christmas from some cute little people named Whos, and spoiler alert, he doesn't. So it all ends well. But I like this story because I think it reflects something that is true of our experience. See, Whoville, in this story, is a happy place. It's a place of singing and laughter and joy. It's the kind of place that we would like to live, that we sometimes imagine we do live in. And yet, there is a Grinch. Every Who down in Whoville liked Christmas, but the Grinch did not. See, we know, we are aware that we don't live in a happy place, that there is pain, there is darkness, there are people who would hurt others, who would oppress and manipulate and destroy. We know that evil is out there. And so we live with this tension that we want something good, we want life to be pleasant and good for everybody, and yet we know it isn't all the time. We know there is pain. We know there is deep suffering. And Christmas is a time, then, when we hope, when we think maybe that that tension could be resolved, that maybe peace is possible. Maybe love is real. Maybe there is hope in the midst of darkness and confusion. But it's worth asking an important question this time of year. Is it real? Is it real that we have hope? Or are we just being optimistic and naive? Is the Christmas season just about wishing something that was true that really can't ever be true? Or is there something that our hope is founded on? Because hope that isn't based on anything is just empty. In fact, it's cruel to have hope when, in fact, there's no reason to have hope. In September, we began a series looking at the biblical book of Daniel, and we called this series When Kingdoms Collide, because we've observed that it describes these two kingdoms and how they regularly come into conflict. There is, on the one hand, the kingdom of man, the things of our daily experience, the governments and the jobs and our lives and our day-to-day activities. And then on the other hand, if you believe in Jesus, there is this other kingdom, this spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of God, where the one who created also came down and redeemed and promises to set things right. In September and October, we looked at six stories that take up the first half of this book, times when those two kingdoms come into conflict. And we found those stories to be helpful ways of mirroring the experiences we have when those kingdoms in our lives come into conflict. But the second half of this book is very different. It's a series of four different visions. These visions are apocalyptic visions. They have to do with the end of the world. They describe a time when the collision of these kingdoms is final and complete. The prophecies predict that eventually there will not be two kingdoms, that the kingdom of man will be drawn up into the kingdom of God, and only God's kingdom will persist. But kingdoms don't give up their power peacefully. So these prophecies are chaotic. They are violent. They are confusing. There are beasts coming out of the sea. There are goats fighting rams with 10 horns. There are scary things. There's something called the abomination of desolation. You know, it's a perfect Advent series, right? Just what we want to hear. over Christmas time. Actually, I'm going to suggest that they are a perfect Advent series. See, the word Advent, as Alma pointed out, means coming. It's a Latin translation, actually, of a Greek word, parousia, which refers to the coming of Jesus. And we often think of Advent as remembering the first coming of Jesus. But in fact, the traditional season of Advent, the church calendar kind of expectation of Advent, is that this is the time during the year where we particularly anticipate the second coming of Jesus. This is the time of the year where we remember that Jesus will, in fact, come back. And so the season leads up to Christmas because in Christmas, we remember that Jesus came once. And so Jesus' first coming becomes this assurance to us, this validation to believe that, in fact, Jesus will come back. We remember Jesus' first coming as a way of anticipating his return. So Advent is about waiting for and hoping for the return of Jesus. And these visions in the book of Daniel will help us to do just that. They will remind us that Jesus will return. And they will offer us hope, because even though they're violent and confusing, they always resolve in peace. You know the phrase, calm before the storm? Well, these visions are like the storm before the calm. They describe this chaos, they describe this confusion, but the point of them is that that chaos is resolved in a time of peace and justice. That calm then gives us hope. So this morning we're going to start with the first vision in Daniel chapter 7. It sets the stage for all the following visions. And it tells the story of four terrible kingdoms that are eventually replaced by a heavenly kingdom. It's very similar to an earlier vision we saw in Daniel chapter 2, where Nebuchadnezzar received a vision of a statue that represented four kingdoms that was eventually replaced by the heavenly kingdom. This vision describes the peace and justice that comes with the kingdom of heaven. It tells us what it looks like when justice prevails. But it also tells us that the process of justice coming takes a while. It seems to last forever. And I think sometimes this is something that we fall trapped to, that we think, you know, it's been over 2,000 years since Jesus came. We've been waiting for him to come back. We think he's going to come back, but is that really real? I mean, maybe it's just good to be a Christian because then you have some values and living by a set of values is a good thing. But do we really believe that God is going to intervene in history, that Jesus will return, and that the world will end somehow and God's kingdom will be established on earth? I mean, I think it's easy to think sometimes, well, that's just what crazy religious people say. Is that really true? Well, let's find out. Let's look at this vision this morning and see what it tells us about the way that history will unfold. And let's see if we have a reason to hope or if our hope is just empty optimism. The chapter begins by telling us about this vision that came during the time of King Belshazzar. Now, if you remember where we are in history, we're in the middle of the 6th century BC. God's people are in exile in Babylon. And if you remember from our earlier stories, we heard a story about King Belshazzar. He was the guy that was king and decided to throw this grand party. And he took the goblets and the various instruments that were stolen from the temple in Jerusalem, and he threw a big party with them. Of course, at that time, his party was interrupted by this hand that wrote on the wall that told him he was going to be judged, and that very night he was killed, and the kingdom was conquered. In the first service when I preached this, I was saying this right as there was thunder in the background, and it was perfect, because that's the point of this vision being introduced as happening during the time of Belshazzar. Thunder is in the background. We know that this is a bad deal. This is a bad guy. We didn't like him then. We're not going to like him now. The context of the story is an evil king who has, as far as we can tell, no good qualities. So let's see what the vision is then that Daniel receives in this context. Here's Daniel 7, verses 2 through 8. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." Merry Christmas, right? A happy story. The way this scene opens is reminiscent of creation. The 4 winds of heaven were stirring the great sea. We might remember in Genesis, we're told that the Spirit of God was hovering over the seas. And in the story found in Genesis, the Spirit of God works on the chaos of the sea and brings order out of it. But this is a different kind of story. In this story, the chaos only gets worse. It only increases. Beast after beast comes out of the sea. First, a lion that can fly with the wings of an eagle and is given the intelligence of a man. That's a dangerous creature. He's then replaced by a bear who seems to be poised, the ribs of a previous meal still in his mouth, given permission to go and devour even more. And that beast is then replaced by this leopard that has wings and 4 heads. How do you escape a beast with 4 heads? It sees everything. And then the 4th beast is even worse. At least the 1st 3 were recognizable. They looked like something. The 4th beast can't even be described. It's just terrifying and dreadful and strong and cruel. And it's got these horns and this little horn that becomes dominant and starts boasting. And it's got eyes like a man. It's a scary vision. What does this mean? Well, Daniel asks the same thing. Later on in the chapter, he asks an angel, "What does all this mean?" And we'll be kind of reading the vision and going back and forth between the interpretation as we work through it to find out what this is all about. But the angel says this in verse 17. "These 4 great beasts are 4 kings who shall arise out of the earth." So the vision describes the way the world works. It's a bleak picture, a series of beastly empires that conquer and destroy and devour. Each one is worse than the last. On the top of every hill, there is a Grinch who does not like Christmas. And when you read a prophecy like this, one of our first inclinations is to want to crack the code, to figure out which beast corresponds to which empire. We do the same things with these horns. There's 10 of them. What does 10 represent? What does it line up with? And if you read commentaries on this chapter, you'll find theory after theory of people proposing empires and kings and world leaders, Rome and Greece and Nazi Germany and Iraq and all different things, trying to match this up with exactly what it refers to. But I want to suggest that we have to be careful here to read the Bible according to the way that it asks to be read. So in the text, when Daniel asks the angel, what does this mean? He is not given a list of specific empires. He's simply given this very broad general response that it refers to four kings who shall arise out of the earth. And perhaps we are meant to read the prophecy in this kind of a general way. A story of the world coming out of creation, kingdom after kingdom that is evil and dark and dangerous. Next week, we'll see when Daniel asks another angel about another vision, he's given a very specific answer. In that case, we know which historical situation we find ourselves in. But here it seems that the purpose of this vision is to set up this template of the way history unfolds. This vision suggests that we live amidst beastly empires. So do we? Is that true? Does that resonate with our experience? I think it does. Look at recent history in the Middle East. One dangerous dictator is taken out only to be replaced by other dangerous forces, who presumably, if they were taken out, might be replaced by even more dangerous forces. The same story plays out all around us. Evil seems uncontrollable. If it isn't a lion, it's a bear. If it's not a leopard, it's a beast we can't even fathom. You may have heard the story of Matt and Grace Wong. Their story has gotten some publicity lately. Matt actually used to attend PBC when he was in grad school at Stanford, and I was in a Bible study with him. Later on, Matt got married, and he and his wife adopted three children from Africa. Now, Matt and his wife are Asian American. They adopted African children, and they moved to Qatar for Matt, who's a civil engineer, to work on the construction projects surrounding preparation for the World Cup there. While they were there, their oldest daughter, who had had a history of eating disorders and some health problems, died unexpectedly. The next day, Matt and his wife were arrested by the Qatari government for murder. See, in Qatar, there isn't much of a category for adoption, and certainly not for interracial adoption. And so, according to the Qatari officials, the only case that made sense was that Matt and Grace had bought these children intending to harvest their organs on the black market. So when their daughter died, they were arrested for murder. They were tried and convicted and sentenced to 3 years. They then appealed that conviction several months ago. And they were let out of prison, but they were told they had to stay in the country. I'm going to give you an update in a little bit on this situation because there's kind of been unfolding in the last couple days, actually. But the situation that Matt and Grace have faced is unthinkable. It's terrifying. It's living amidst beastly empires, longing for justice. But don't think that that only happens out there. That's not just something that other people experience. I mean, we have darkness, we have evil, we have beastly empires right here in Palo Alto. We have children that can't find a reason not to kill themselves. We have people working three jobs, desperately trying to afford some place to live that simply can't. They're working poor, forced out of their housing. We have families broken apart by violence or infidelity. We're surrounded by darkness. Life is hard. It's full of suffering and pain. The empires we live around might look nicer, but they are just as power hungry as the ones described by Daniel. What are we to do? Right about now, you're thinking, man, I walked into this building and it looked so nice and there were garlands and Christmas lights. I felt so good. And Paul, you've just totally torn all that away. I was whistling jingle bells, but no more. Well, what about Advent? How does this connect? Well, if this is the way the world is, if it's true that we live amidst beastly empires, what are we to do? Does God offer us anything? Well, let's see what happens next in the vision. Here's Daniel 7, 9 through 10. As I looked, this is Daniel looking on, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Something's about to happen. This is a dramatic scene. It's a courtroom scene. The judge has arrived. The courtroom is packed. Something is about to happen. This phrase, the Ancient of Days, it's the only time we ever hear this title, but we know who's being talked about. This is God. This is the ultimate judge. He has arrived. And we hope, we pray that he is bringing justice to this situation. Isn't this what we want when bad things happen? When everything happened in Ferguson, Missouri, when a white police officer shot an unarmed young black man, the whole country waited to hear what the courts would say. We want to know what will happen. Will justice be done? When we hear a story like Matt and Grace, we want somebody to do something. We want to call the president or an ambassador or the Justice Department. We want intervention. We want justice to be delivered. We want the books to be opened and the pronouncement made. And the truth is, we spend a lot of time in this place waiting, hoping for justice, for something to be done in that moment when we don't quite know what will happen. That moment sometimes lasts a long time. And what can happen is that we can lose hope. We can get tired of waiting. We can get disillusioned and think that maybe justice will never arrive. We get worn out. Later on in the chapter, Daniel asks this angel for more information, and this is what he's told. In Daniel 7:25, again, speaking of the little horn, the angel says, "He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time." God has predicted that the saints of the Most High will be worn out by the evil of the world. They will long for something to happen. The call of following God, the call that we have as Christians is to endure, to wait, to endure this period of longing. We endure beastly empires. Endure beastly empires. The danger of the Christmas season is that it can be terribly naive. It can be just empty. All we need is a Santa Claus in the mall, and everybody's going to be happy. One more Jimmy Stewart movie, and that'll bring world peace. But we know that there is evil out there, and that it seems to go on forever, and we wonder if God is ever going to show up. Will the courts ever actually do anything? And this is what this phrase means that the angel says. They shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. It's an enigmatic phrase. It's mysterious. People have tried to figure out what it means. It seems to be referring to a season of time, a period, followed by twice that period, and then half that period. Now, if you add this up, you get three, one plus two, or you get 3.5, 1 plus 2 plus 1/2. And a lot of people think maybe this refers to 3.5 years or 3.5 periods of time. And there's theories about how that might fit into some end time chronology, and those things are possible, but I think the first way to interpret this is that it's simply a progression of time that is interrupted. See, if I start counting 1, 2, what do you think is coming next? 3. Or if you're a mathematician and you're doubling things, maybe four or prime numbers, you know, there's various ways. But the sequence continues. It gets bigger and bigger, one and two and more. But this sequence, a time, times and a half, it's interrupted. The sequence that you expect to continue stops without warning. Something's going to happen. This is that moment when the books are opened. Just when we think it's going on and on forever, one season, two seasons, more and more, just when we think there's no hope, something happens. There is a moment, there is an event, and we want to know, what is it? Is it good? At the end of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, there's this dramatic scene where the Grinch has all the presents from Whoville loaded up on his sleigh, and he rides it up to the tip-top of Mount Crumpet to dump it. And there's this moment where the sleigh is tottering on the edge of this mountain, and the Grinch listens for what's going to happen in Whoville now that they have no presents. And we wonder, we wait, what will happen in that moment? Well, the sequence continues. The vision resolves. Listen to what happens in verses 11 to 14. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. And as for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As Daniel looks on, the terrifying fourth beast that can't even be described is killed. The bad guy loses. And then we meet the good guy. He shows up, he's described as one like a son of man. That phrase, in its original usage, just means he's human. But he's coming with the clouds, which is something in the Old Testament that only God does. And so there's this character that is human, but from God, and he arrives, and he's given an eternal kingdom. The king that we've waited for, the good king, the one that will bring justice, has shown up. And this is what we long for during the season of Advent. This is what happened 2,000 years ago. God did come in the form of a human. The king did come to earth. God did intervene once. Everybody was surprised. They had given up hope after hundreds of years of silence. It seemed like the sequence was going to last forever. But then in a surprising way, in a surprising place, a baby was born. And God entered this world in a new way. And hope was given. And because God came once, we can believe that he will come again. We live amidst beastly empires, and our call is to endure those times, but as we endure, we do so knowing that the sequence will be interrupted, that God will come back, that Jesus will return. As we endure, we also expect Jesus to return. Christians aren't the only ones interested in the end of the world. Our culture loves end-of-the-world stories. There's movies and books and video games about the end of the world. I preached on this passage several years ago in the Young Adult Fellowship, and it was right around the time that the movie 2012 was coming out. This was when people thought the world might end in 2012, which they were apparently mistaken. And so right after hearing this message, we then went to the midnight showing of the opening of 2012. So we got the biblical version of the apocalypse and the Hollywood version of the apocalypse. And spoiler alert, somebody saves the world in the movie. So it all ends well. But we have to ask, why are we so fascinated by these types of stories? Why do we love to hear about the world ending? So I dug up an article interviewing several authors on why they write stories about the apocalypse. And here's a quote from M.R. Carey, author of The Girl with All the Gifts. She said this, "We're drawn to the idea of civilization coming crashing to the ground because it would make most of our day-to-day worries irrelevant at a stroke. You'd never have to fret about going into the office again, about traffic, or money worries, or noisy neighbors, or political corruption, or your kids getting on at school. It's like what Renton says about heroin addiction and train spotting. It just gives you the one big thing to worry about, so all the scary complexity of life fades away." There are so many small things that consume our lives. Perhaps that is not true, that is true even more during the Christmas season. And we know that they're not really that important. We know that they're small. And we desperately want to find some way to clear away the clutter, to remember what's truly important, to focus on that one big thing. And that's my hope for this morning. I know that life is complex. I know there is so much to worry about, so many things going on. But let me suggest that throughout this season of Advent, you give attention to the one big thing that this is all about. Jesus is coming back. It's the only thing that gives us hope. It's the only way that we know that it's right to be joyful during this season. We live amidst beastly empires, and it is hard to know what to do about that. What do we do about events in Ferguson, Missouri? How do you make sense of that? Who's right? Who's wrong? How do you clear up the mess? What do you do about friends that are accused of murder after trying to adopt kids to give them a better life? How is it fair that most of us ate a huge meal on Thanksgiving when others around the world are starving? What do we do with all this? I don't know. But I do know that Jesus is coming back and that he brings justice and peace and righteousness to the world that he created and he redeemed. The story in this vision that Daniel received ends with the Son of Man receiving a heavenly kingdom. It's a good ending. It's the ending we want. It might take a while to get there. It might be chaotic and confusing to get there, but it does get there. And God gives us stories like that, stories with endings, because so many of the stories in our lives don't have endings yet. We live in that place of waiting to find out how it's going to turn out. And so we need to know that at the end of the day, the one big thing that we hope for will happen. Jesus will come back. As I worked on this sermon last night, I saw an update about Matt and Grace Wong's situation. I knew I was going to be sharing their story, so I looked up the latest, and at the moment I was working on this, at about 9 p.m. last night, they were going into court to hear the results of their appeal. And I checked back about an hour later, and it turned out that the judge acquitted them of all charges. They were declared innocent, but the story continues. Apparently this morning, they tried to leave the country and there is still a travel ban on them. And it seems like perhaps the country is, the prosecutor is trying to charge them again. And so in the first service, I said their story had a happy ending and now we don't know. But this is what happens. We don't know how our stories end. We need God to tell us that the ultimate story will end well because we live amid so much uncertainty. Because Jesus is coming back, we can have real hope. We don't know how these little things in our lives will work out, but we do know how the one big thing will come to conclusion. So what do we do as we hope then? Well, Daniel responded to his vision, and I'd like to suggest that his response can guide us. Listen to verse 28. "Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Daniel received this terrifying, confusing vision, and I think it gave him hope, but it also made him confused and probably a little scared. So he kept the matter in his heart. Now, if you're familiar with the Christmas story, that might remind you of a similar phrase that we hear in the Christmas story. Years later, an angel came to a young virgin, engaged to be married, and told her that she was pregnant by way of the Holy Spirit, that she would have a child who would inherit a kingdom, an eternal kingdom, and who would serve with justice and bring peace. Sure enough, this young woman gave birth to a baby. Shepherds came out of nowhere and worshiped him. Kings came bringing gifts to this baby. And in Luke 2:19, we were told that at the end of all of this, this is what she said. Mary treasured up all these things, pondering them in her heart. All of this is a lot to take in. Beasts with 10 horns, evil that seems to last forever, virgins getting pregnant, kings bringing gifts to a baby, old men on thrones. What are we to do with all of this? Well, I want to suggest for us that we start by keeping it in our hearts, by reflecting on it. I want to maybe suggest to you that as you leave from here, you're going to see a bunch of Christmas decorations. You're going to get flyers in the mail. You're going to see Santas in malls. Let that be a reminder to you, not of the commercialization or of the presents you have to shop for, but of this one big thing, that Jesus is coming back. Let that expectation sit in your heart. We don't wait passively. God will use that to move us to action. An expectation like that, that we are awaiting eagerly a king to bring justice, means we live differently. It means we get involved in that. But I want to suggest to you that you ask God what that looks like for you. Keep that matter in your heart and ask God to reveal how it might change you this Advent season. We are surrounded by beastly empires, and yet we live in hope because Jesus will return. Endure and expect. Amen.